online at bbc.co.uk/5live. This is the UK's home of live news and live sport.
5live.
We can't have Lord Winston. Dr. Kermode will do fine.
Yes. A doctor is just a lesser version of a lord anyway.
This correspondent, loads of correspondents coming in, so we can deal with this. Just remind us of the movies we're going to be doing after three, apart from Sir Alan Parker coming, which is very exciting.
Fantastic. Tim Burton's Corpse Bride, Emma Thompson's Nanny McPhee, Beautiful Boxer, and Sky High. It's just, you know, packed. I've got to tell you, and of course, Broken Flowers. So, in fact, there's at least...
That's a Bill Murray film.
Yeah, there's at least three movies that I'm very excited about.
Is it a particular half-time... Half-term, even.
It is, yeah, it is definitely half-term when you've got Nanny McPhee and Corpse Bride and Sky High and, you know, other stuff sort of all competing. But there's really no prizes for guessing in advance which of the movies I think you should be sending your little toddlers to.
Dr. Kermode says Jay Heath. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've mentioned new DVD releases particularly anymore, but I recently acquired the original Bedazzled.
Oh, yeah.
Starring Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. It's very funny, intelligent, strangely compelling. I think I must have watched it 15 times already. In the light of what you were saying last week about very British films, I think this one is worth a mention.
It's a fantastic film. And the moment in which how the fall from heaven happened, when he sits on top of a post box and he says, right, I'm God, dance round me, saying, ooh, you're wonderful. And Dudley Moore goes, ooh, you're wonderful, ooh, you're marvellous, ooh, you're fantastic, ooh, this is boring, can I sit there? And he goes, exactly.
Word for word.
That is, yeah.
Andrew at Hertford College, actually, in Oxford. Simon, could Mark settle a debate my friend and I have? Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, we watched Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire.
Yes, or Wings Over Berlin, depending on whether we're using the original German.
It was we're clearly using the English.
The English. The American, I think, actually.
I think it is a flawed masterpiece. Daryl, however, thinks it's a piece of rubbish, a waste of several hours of his life, and claims that he's tried hard to erase it from his memory. We both agreed that the remake, City of Angels, was appalling. Mm. The debate was recently reignited by a national newspaper giving away a free copy, complete with all the critics' praises from its release. We've decided that the time has come to appeal to a higher power. There you are, we're back into the realms of divinity again. And as we both deeply respect Mark's opinion, we'd be very grateful if he could adjudicate on this long-running dispute. So for Andrew Porter at Harvard College in Oxford, Wings of Desire, a flawed masterpiece or a complete waste of time?
I think it's a flawed masterpiece. I mean, I really, really like it. And there's a marvellous moment in the Wim Wenders documentary called Motion and Emotion, in which there's a German critic who sums up the way that Wenders has kind of annexed a beautiful kind of middle ground. He says that all Wim Wenders movies come down to the three following phrases. Women are strange, aren't they? And children are strange, aren't they? Let's put another record on the jukebox.
Is that it?
That's it.
Life will be a lot easier. So if you've got any other disputes that need sorting out, Andrew, I think you've won there. And Daryl clearly doesn't know what he's talking about. And thanks for the advice on this text. Forget the news, Simon. Get Kermode in for a rare bout of overtime. So you're always very useful.
Thank you. Polly filler.
Chris in Leeds. I saw Mark on TV the other day. He looks like Marcus Tandy off El Dorado, which you wouldn't get because that was an old...
No, but that's that guy Jesse Birdsall, who is my doppelganger. That Jesse Birdsall and I used to look a lot more like each other when we were younger. The difference is that whereas Jesse Birdsall has stayed fairly thin, some of us have expanded with the years.
Mark Kermode is here. Sir Alan Parker joins us as well. Alan, good afternoon to you.
Hello.
This from David on an email. We don't need Lord Winston to talk about God. We have our own supreme being to worship in the form of Mark Kermode. On the first day, he slagged off Revenge of the Sith. On the second, he ripped into Revolver. On the third, he watched The Exorcist. On the fourth day, he praised Kurt Cronenberg at length. On the fifth day, he lauded Lord of the Rings. On the sixth, he watched Exorcist II, The Heretic, and Pirates of the Caribbean. And on the seventh day, he ranted, and so on. So,
it's a high class of listener, really, isn't it?
I reckon.
Yeah.
Alan Parker's... And then, unfortunately, though, then I just see the next one on the pile.
Go on.
It says... From Dylan in Charlton Kings. Yes. What does Mark know of an Exorcist DVD box set?
Oh, yeah.
And what is the verdict of a Paul Schrader prequel cut? Well, I know what you're going to say.
Do you want the short version?
Can we hold on to that? I think...
I can do, but I mean, I can give you the short version.
Go on.
Okay, well, the Paul Schrader prequel is...
I'll just read Alan's book.
It's infinitely better than the Rennie Harlin version, but it's still boring, because basically it's a well-made film with an excellent performance by Stellan Skarsgård, beautifully shot by Vittorio Storaro, but based on a script which is essentially dull. And so you get a choice. It's the Harlin is stupid, the Schrader is dull. There you go.
That was the short answer.
That was the short one. I'll give you the long one, but I don't think you want to hear it.
No, you can tell Sir Alan later. Hello, Alan.
I'll skip that one.
Yes. So
thanks
will we.
Very much for the offer.
Will write and direct for food is a new book of cartoons from Alan Parker. Alan, you've done a couple of books of cartoons before, which I've missed entirely, obviously because they weren't sent to me. this third book is fantastic, and it looks as though some of them look a bit battered, as though they've been reclaimed from walls around the world. Is that true?
Yeah, well, I first started to do them, not really in any sort of sensible professional way, but I used to do them particularly to studio executives and things. If I wanted to say something rude, you can either pick up the phone and screen them at somebody, or you can write a rude letter or whatever. But I'd started, you know, 20-odd years ago, I started to do these cartoons in which you could say incredibly rude things about people. Like Mark, for instance, I could send, you know, lots of to critics I sent. And, of course, they're never...
I've never had one from
you. No, you will, don't worry.
Okay. There was a much bloodied critic in one of these cartoons. Anyway, Alan, sorry, go on.
No, but the thing is, what's funny about cartoons is that however rude you are, next time you go to that executive or whatever office, they've got the cartoon in a frame on the wall, and you think, actually, it was meant to be very insulting and rude. But there's something about humour or just drawing it that actually, I don't know, it just doesn't seem quite so bad.
Has anyone taken offence? Because you don't pull any punches on these.
They did, well, not really. I mean, Merchant Ivory were the ones who were most upset about things. I mean, I did a cartoon about 20-odd years ago where I said, you know, I described Merchant Ivory's films as the Laura Ashley School of Filmmaking, and it became kind of how people described their work if they wanted to be critical, and so much so that even in Ishmael Merchant's obituaries, they mentioned the line, which actually was a cartoon joke. And Ishmael years ago did ask me for the original of this cartoon, which I'd sent him a version of it, which apparently tore up. But I think it upsets Ivory, who's got absolutely no sense of humour whatsoever. Anybody seen his films, you'd know that. But the reason I published it or put it again is because I know that it really, really irritates Ivory.
There's a splendid... Well, we had Nick Park in a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about Wallace and Gromit, of course, and it's this wonderful image of which he was talking about, of Jeffrey Katzenberg coming over. We mention this every week, but is still a great image of him landing at Bristol Airport, where they extend the runway deliberately so that Mr. Katzenberg can come over on a regular basis.
Land his Learjet.
Gives all the notes to the Aardman people, and they clearly said thanks very much and go away, and then Mr. Katzenberg goes away. So I was intrigued to come across this cartoon. Mark, can you just describe it?
It's the Katzenberg memo, and it is basically a toilet roll. And well, that's it. Ink and cold coffee on toilet paper, 4x6, courtesy of Doris and Harvey, can I say that? Frothstacker Foundation. And it is
It's beautiful. So what was it?
Katzenberg's memo.
Well, the description is on the left of what that means. The Katzenberg memo, as Mark knows, is that some years ago when Katzenberg was at Paramount, at Disney, excuse me.
Disney.
He sent out a famous memo called the Katzenberg Memo. The memo basically complained about the fact that films were too expensive and the people who make them, i.e. me and others, and particularly the camera crews, earned too much money. On 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was Forbes said that Katzenberg was worth $800 million. After selling the DreamWorks animation, he's probably worth well over $1 billion, Katzenberg. Which is kind of ironic that he should be so attentive to the overtime of poor old camera assistant. I've known Jeffrey for 30-odd years. In actual fact, when I first showed Bugsy Malone, he went and made me a cup of coffee and brought it, because he was only a very humble assistant at the time. But he's done rather well, there's no doubt.
He has. I mean, have you seen the Wallace and Gromit movie?
I haven't, but I love Nick Park. I think it's brilliant.
I mean, it would be... Who knows? This is just our interpretation of it, wasn't it, Mark? But there's no Katzenberg in it. It's all
no. I think that's exactly it. I mean, as I said, having been on stage with Jeffrey Katzenberg and having been called a fool in public by Jeffrey Katzenberg, I think I can say, you know, that my impression of it is that Katzenberg would say, "You got to do this, you got to do that, you got to do the other," and they go, "Yeah, great, see you in a fortnight." And then they just get back to moving things just a little bit. And then by the time the film's finished, you can't do anything about it anyway. I mean, there's apparently the only thing they gave in on was that in America, they don't understand what melons are. No, no, they don't understand what marrows are.
That's
so
right,
they changed it to melon, because apparently in America marrow is a squash, but it didn't match up with the lip movement, so they said, fine, you can have melons.
It's difficult to do cartoons on the radio, let's be honest.
Yes, but can we describe the Madonna one, which is Madonna's singing lesson? Madonna's singing lesson, and she's going, me, 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 me.
And the line is, the vocal coach says, no, dear, it's do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. So that's a complete joke. Yeah, man.
And what was the experience?
You're right, you can't do it on radio.
And what was your experience that led to that?
Well, I made a veto.
I know you did, but so at what stage? I mean, because that's actually potentially, you know, if you'd showed that to her during the movie, maybe she'd have upped and gone.
She did see it. No, she thought it was quite funny at the time. No, not really. No, I think that the thing about her is that she's, I actually got on very, very well with her, so I don't have anything bad to say about her, except the fact that she is extraordinarily hardworking, extraordinary professional, and incredibly selfish, and she knows that more than anybody else. In fact, she'd be the first to tell you that. That's why she does what she does so well, because she is incredibly self-centred.
But she had to petition you several times to get the role in Evita, because wasn't there like three or four occasions in which she had to come to you and say, I really am the person for this role, before you finally caved in?
Well, the studio and people were talking about different people, but she was one at the time. She wrote me a huge long letter to say how much she thought she was the right person to do it, which actually I think, you know, if you're a director, is rather flattering when somebody really wants to do it that badly. So I always liked her for that, and I think that she did, you know, whether you like the film or not, she was actually, I think, quite
brilliant. Is on record.
We disagree on a lot of things, but we both agree on the fact that Evita was terrific.
I loved Evita. I went in, you know, not knowing what, so I absolutely loved it.
Good for you.
There you go. Right, I'm going to try another cartoon on the radio.
Humiliating for me.
Yeah, okay. A couple of castaways on the proverbial desert island. One has just opened a note, which clearly has arrived in a bottle. It says, Gangs of New York wasn't very good, and neither was Aviator. You missed nothing. You know, now I can imagine that when you're doing these and passing them round, it's a bit like passing around a note in the back of a fifth-year history lesson. You know, great guffaws from everyone. But who did you give that to? Because this is one of those ones, Alan, that it looks as though it's been pinned on someone's wall and you've been allowed to photograph.
I think I can't really say who it was sent to. I think the thing behind it was that, you know, there's...
Would it be Leonardo DiCaprio?
I just think that, you know, I'm a huge admirer and be very, you know, dumb, really, as he's sort of contemporary, although he's older than me, Scorsese. He's obviously a really great filmmaker. But sometimes when I hear him speak, I think, oh, God, you know, you're starting to believe your own publicity. He's actually a little bit too pleased with himself, because he's made a lot of dodgy films as well. And I just thought that it's rather nice now and again to actually... you know, for me as a filmmaker, to have a go at somebody who's supposedly so perfect.
You're going to read this one out, Mark, because it's about the death of a film critic.
Okay.
Today.
It's the one with all the blood. More cartoons on the radio.
As a film critic, incidentally, it is very nice to sit next to a filmmaker bad-mouthing other filmmakers, because the thing that we always get to, obviously, well, you critics, you know, I mean, you said this when we were outside, you know, we take 2 years to make a film and it takes you 5 minutes to destroy it, but it's good to see you as a filmmaker joining in.
While you're just reading it through, this from Alan in Newcastle, Talon Parker, I was an extra in Bugsy Malone. How about a remake with the same cast?
That'd be good, yeah. That'd be, all of them would be about 45 now, yeah.
Which kind of defeat the object, really.
Right, shall I read this out? So it is a bloodied corpse lying on the floor, surrounded by two policemen and a guy with a camera, and the detective is saying to the other one, he's a film critic, sir, stabbed through the heart with a rusty film can, gratuitously violent, with a dubious, if somewhat unconvincing plot, but generally well-executed, if a little cliched, with a strong central performance.
See, I think that's great. I wouldn't mind. In fact, Stephen Fry, in his introduction to the book, says you need to buy three, one to keep, one to give to a friend, another one to cut out and frame on assorted walls, which I can imagine a number of people doing. Well, maybe just getting the one. This from Christopher. He says, could you ask Sir Alan if he'll be advertising his book on the big screen at Highbury tomorrow? I used to sit behind him in West Upper for many years and now moved down a few rows.
Now, that's really interesting. Actually, I was the only film director ever to have... for the life of David Gow, actually, the distributor for me did a commercial at halftime, and instead of saying directed by Alan Parker at the end of it, as it does, it says starring Kevin Spacey, it says directed by Alan Parker in the West Stand Upper.
So clearly you need to do that again, because it worked.
I don't know, actually. We look forward to... I can't be there tomorrow, actually, so I can say... What's interesting was to listening to the news. That's the first time I've been so close to someone doing the news. And the quote about Pires, about Henri, was so inaccurate to the actual thing. And you wonder how you pricey these things, because this is BBC. You'd think you'd be slightly more accurate than what he said. And that was, or maybe I'm too biased as a...
What was the
Arsenal supporter. No, the things were... the Sun quote, as opposed to the Telegraph quote. The Telegraph quote being a little more comprehensive. And because you have to condense it into your news into, like, two or three lines, it starts to be... you hear it all the time when you get radio doing their own praises of what they've read in the tabloids that morning. Isn't really professional news, in my opinion. And it's the first time I've ever experienced it, being so close to someone doing it.
Did you want to hit Vassos then? When he was, we'll get the original quote and we'll...
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, yeah.
And we'll check it out. What is your assessment then of what Pires and Henri were trying to say? Because clearly the implication is...
Well, the news there was that Pires has joined that thing. But it was not... It's like, you know, if it's two sentences that are reduced to one, then the one... seems to be, depending with what kind of supporter you are, which, you know, sometimes you can tell in any newspaper who you know, which actual team they support themselves with regards to their attitude to whether it be about Chelsea or Arsenal or whatever, you know.
Well, while you're with us, we'll try and get the full quote.
Yes.
And we'll put it in context and see what you make of it. Is that okay?
I prefer to talk about my book and movies.
Well, you started talking about
it. Which is basically Alan Parker critic. There we go. You see, Alan.
No, it's just I know Alan Parker, Arsenal supporter, who's desperate not to lose Henri.
Did most of these cartoons come from a particular period in your life, Alan?
They're over a period of like 20 odd years, but. I was surprised when I put them all together, there was a big chunk from the period when I was actually living in Los Angeles, which was about 10 years. And I always thought that I really enjoyed it. But when you start to look at the stuff, because a lot of those cartoons were sent to other people, a lot were actually done for a particular reason. But a lot of them were done to, like, you know, when you do that, it's like a memo to self, you know?
Yes.
It's like you wanted to get something off your chest, so I would do a cartoon. And it's like more for me than anybody else. And you suddenly see there's kind of, there, a lot of them are quite angry about the system and I suppose they were reflective of my time working within that Hollywood system.
It's interesting that because Ridley Scott does the same thing as well, as he draws all the time. He does those little Ridleygrams.
Yeah.
And of course, you and he both come out with, you know, similar kind of advertising background.
Well, I mean, I'm a cartoonist, so mine are kind of crude. He's a fantastic artist, I think, Ridley. But, you know, Ridley is like Royal College of Art trained and different. I think the reason that we both do it so much is that... you know, there's two ways. If you have a screenplay, which is actually the blueprint for everybody to understand what kind of film you're making. Now, if you're Spielberg, for instance, you get a storyboard artist, because Steven can't draw at all, for instance. He gets a storyboard artist to do it's called The Bible, and it's a complete storyboard of every single shot, which he does with the storyboard artist before you start filming. So yeah. If you're the camera operator or anybody else, you really know what's going on. It's a fantastic way for everybody to know what's going on. However, it is very rigid way of making films compared to the European way. So what you kind of, the compromise really, is that if you're trying to explain a shot to a cameraman or a production designer or anybody on the film set, actor even, it's easier to pick up a pencil and draw it, the frame that you're trying to achieve.
Sure.
And so you find yourself drawing all the time. You know, a lot of the drawings that I do are that way around. And, you know, Ridley has an incredible facility for doing that.
I think if anyone is obviously if they're a movie fan, they'll get an awful lot more of it. But I think if you're just a fan of cartoons, like, for example, my favourite is always Matt in the Telegraph, whose drawings are great, but the words are fantastic as well. I think if you're just a fan of great cartoons, you're going to love this book.
Mm.
I mean, I it's embarrassing to say it with you in front of us, but these are brilliant cartoons and very funny. I look to Mark for support here.
No, I think they're great. No, listen,
I think
they're really good. I think they're really funny. I think they're really smart. I think the best thing about Alan, quite apart from the fact that he's made some movies which I absolutely love, some movies which I absolutely hate, is that there is too much nowadays of people within the film industry being incredibly precious and incredibly pussyfooting. You know, how many times have we interviewed film guests who have just refused to say anything other than it was marvellous working with him, her. I really hope I work with him. I understand.
But that's protective.
I understand that, but it's very. But actually, even when even when it was within your interest to be protective, you weren't. It's not just that you're now, you know, you've now done enough that you don't have. You never were. You were always.
Well, it can be pretty dumb. I have always been, yeah. And sometimes you can, you know, I don't know. I think that there's nothing wrong with that. But I think that, you know, if you've made a film and you know, you want to say, well, yeah, but did you really get on well with Madonna? Well, I happened to say more things than most people in those. I kind of did, you know.
Yes.
And if she'd have been very difficult, I said so, and I have said so with regards to certain people who have been very difficult. But mostly what you're trying to do, when you come onto a programme like this, quite frankly, you're selling something. You want someone to go and see your movie, and therefore, because you want them to go and see your movie, you say positive things, not negative things. Because if you say, oh, it was a complete nightmare, everybody hated one another, and, you know, and everybody tried to kill Scorsese his third day on Casino, he's not going to tell everybody that. Because
Terry Gilliam does. Terry Gilliam tells everybody absolutely everything about what happened, you know.
He does. Well, Terry is very honest person, but also Terry has been through the worst experience of any human being who ever made a movie.
Alan, can you stay with us about another 5 minutes, because we just want to wrap up with your book and do the box office top 10 and stuff. We'll be back with Mark Kerman, who's here, Movie Conversation, and also Sir Alan Parker is here with his book Will Write and Direct for Food. You've mentioned a few difficult people, Alan. Who is the most talented actor you've worked with who's been extremely well adjusted and deeply pleasant at all times?
Oh, God, what a question. I think I need a bit more time to think about that one.
I suppose people might assume from the outside that the most talented and the most famous movie stars are, by definition, extremely difficult to work with.
Well, I think that if you're searching for something special, to be very brief about it, you kind of do question everything. But there are very nice people who can question everything. I mean, Kate Winslet, you know, she would question everything that I was doing, but in such a way that you feel like you're both going in the same direction, as opposed to being aggressive about it and unpleasant, which some people do out of, often actors who are so fearful of what they're doing that they actually aren't very well behaved.
Okay, well, we'll try and think of someone who is fantastically talented and extremely well adjusted before you leave us. We're also trying to get to the bottom of the Arsenal quotes, which you were talking about. Movie reviews to come before 4 o'clock on Broken Flowers and Nanny McPhee, Sky High, Beautiful Boxer and Tim Burton's Corpse Bride. The box office top 10. So what we'll do is Mark will do his normal sort of 6-paragraph assessment, which often takes longer than the actual movie. And then Sir Alan, if he has anything to say, we'll chip in.
Can I just say, if you're referring to him as Sir Alan, can I be Dr. Mark, since, you know, if we're on titles terms?
Okay, as long as you call me Dr. Simon, then that'll
be
fine.
But you're not Dr. Simon. I am Dr. Mark.
What are you, a medical doctor?
No, I've got a PhD. I'm not a medical doctor.
That's not a doctor.
Excuse
PhD.
I have a certificate.
Yeah, but they're to a penny, aren't they, PhDs?
Good point, Sir Alan.
As you were.
As opposed to knighthoods.
As opposed to knighthoods, yes.
Yeah, they're even easier. I said, mine was really terrific until Ridley Scott got it.
But peers of the realm don't turn up on time, so give me a knight any day. At number 10 this week, Goal.
It's okay. I mean, I have no interest in football, and it's a kind of romantic story with a lot of saccharin in it. And Danny Cannon has obviously spent a lot of time in America, and, you know, it is what it is. And it was far less painful than I expected it to be.
Sir Alan?
I was going to say pass, but that's actually kind of almost
quite
a joke.
Good.
I think football films are really hard to shoot, very difficult to achieve. Other sporting films like boxing, that more successful historically, very hard to pull off.
Have you ever seen a good football movie?
Never.
See, most people go for Escape to Victory, but the fact is, it's rubbish.
Of course it is. Four Brothers at Nine.
I didn't like it at all. John Singleton has, for me, gone completely off the boil, and I wish he would make a return to form. I know this performed well in America, but I just think it's a mess, and it doesn't know whether it wants to be a serious movie or an action adventure, and ends up being none.
Alan Parker.
Which, are we talking about Goal?
No, Four Brothers.
Don't know. Not a big fan, so I'm not... I defer to you there.
Did you nod off for a moment there?
No, sorry, I didn't know where we were on the list.
Right, number 8.
This is new to me. So that's great to be able to comment on what you think.
You think film criticism's easy, and then...
It's not, I'm amazed.
Here we are at the coalface.
Okay, number 8, David Cronenberg's History of Violence.
Outside, John the producer said to both me and Alan...
I find he's an editor, but anyway, go on.
Sir John, the editor, said, which film would you go and see if you had one night off? And I said History of Violence, and Alan said Crash, the Paul Haggis Crash as opposed to the Cronenberg Crash. But we both agreed that actually they are both terrific movies. Somebody fantastically sent me the graphic novel of History of Violence with a very coherent letter. We said they really didn't like the film because there's a bunch of stuff in the graphic novel that isn't in the film. I'm now 3/4 of the way through the graphic novel. Yes, there is a lot of stuff in it that isn't in the film, but I'm glad it's not in the film. And incidentally, if you were the person who sent me this novel, please email me your name and address, because I've now lost it. And I would like to have a discussion with you about this. But I love that film. I think it's the best film I've seen this year.
Yeah, I think, between Crash... They happen to be showing at the same time at the moment, so, yeah, I think that the person who was asking us questions said he's got a babysitter for the first time in 3 months. What film should he go and see? And I said, well, you're really lucky because Crash is out at the moment, which for me is the most intelligent, best film for a long, long time, and followed very closely by History of Violence. So it's two really very, very, very good films. I would agree with you entirely there, Mark.
Number seven is Domino.
Which is rubbish. I mean, you know, I'm really sorry about this. I think it's Tony Scott's worst film to date. I think it's completely vacuous, empty, morally repugnant. I can't believe that it's based on the life of somebody he actually knew. And I thought it was a real car crash of a film, and I really hated it.
Very interesting, yeah. I think you're probably right. I know Tony Scott, so I'd be very...
There are films of Tony Scott's that I've liked.
He's really... unfairly he's often called the dopey brother, and I think that he's better than that. But actually, I don't know. I think that this is probably not a great movie.
Serenity at six.
I enjoyed it, having never seen the TV show that it was based on. I'm actually quite a fan of Joss Whedon. I thought it was, you know, intelligent fun. A critic said it's the film that George Lucas would have made had he been a human being as opposed to an android. And I think that actually there is some truth in that. It was Nigel Floyd said that, and I think he was right.
I haven't seen it.
There's a good Star Wars cartoon in there, though, which I can't repeat because the language is a tad strong, but you need the language in there, I think. Oliver Twist at five.
You know... I don't understand people being bowled over by it as they are. I really, really like the musical. I know people are kind of rather down on it, but I really like it. I think there is more darkness and actually sometimes closer to the grotesquery of the source novel in the musical than there is in the Polanski film. For me, the problem with the Polanski film is it's neither a full-blooded Polanski film nor a fully-fledged literary adaptation. It's just a bit ordinary, which for that story is a bit shocking.
Charlie?
I think it's great that he did it. I think it's quite shameful, actually, that it's done by Roman living in France to get that film together. You know, it's a classic thing that ought to be done by the British film industry as such.
Well, because we did do it twice and did it very well.
Well, I suppose because we haven't tackled it. It's the kind of film that we'd all like to do, you know, but because you revere particularly the lean version, that you'd probably think, oh, no, you shouldn't touch it. And then the lean version followed by the musical is probably, and then done on television, obviously, you shouldn't really do it. And Roman doesn't have that history, so he just thought, oh, well, I'll go and do it. And I think if you've not seen any of those others, I think that this is a pretty terrific version of a book.
But equally, if you have not seen any of those others, what have you been doing with your life?
That's true, but, you know, I assume it goes to young people who might not have done that.
Okay.
Kinky Boots at four?
It's okay. I mean, it's got its heart in the right place. It wants to be full Monty and drag, and it kind of isn't. It's got a very good performance by Chiwetel Ejiofor, who I think is really terrific. It creaks around a lot, but it means well.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Pride and Prejudice at three?
I don't get the fuss. Everyone says it's fantastically earthy, fantastically down to earth. I don't think it is. If that's a dirty, filthy, muddy environment, you really should come and see Where I Live. You know, it's okay, but it's no more than okay. And I was kind of surprised by just how much people were saying vibrant, terrific, wonderful. I also think that it is lacking in the pizzazz of the television version. Incidentally, can I finally lay to rest? People keep saying Mark Kermode says he hasn't got a telly. I've had a telly for years. I didn't have a telly, and then I reneged on this, and I got a telly. I am no longer the person that thinks that all television is the work of the devil, OK? I know I did, but I changed.
You were right first time, I think. have you seen it, Sralin?
Yeah, I think that he's right, actually, with the joke. I don't know about the telly stuff, but with regards to... I think it's very good. I think if someone actually wants to go and see a good movie, then they should go and see it. It's not as great as everybody might be saying, I think, but very, very worth going to see.
Number two is Lords of War.
Lord of War. Which, you know, again, all its ambitions are strong. I mean, it wants to be Deal of the Century mixed with Doctor Strangelove, and sadly it isn't either of them. It's one of those films which you come out thinking, I feel that I have been politically edified, but on an entertainment level I've been kind of bored and lost. And it's a shame. It's very, very hard to do a gripping satire on the arms industry.
Alan, have you seen Lord of War?
I haven't. I mean, I think it's... just to read the one-liner of it, and with Nick Cage in it, I thought, well, actually, that sounds like a fantastically interesting subject.
It does, and it is a fantastically interesting subject.
I don't know what poster they're using here. They have the best, most graphic poster in America, which is so fantastic. It's like the most original poster. But so you think, oh, is that an original movie? I don't know.
What's on the poster?
The idea of it, I thought, was good. For a commercial American movie, tackle that subject.
The poster here is just Nick Cage looking at you. There may be the sort of the floor of bullets behind him, I think.
Yeah, but his whole face is made into bullets and made made up of.
No, not in the English poster. Yeah.
Number one this week in the UK, Wallace and Gromit, Curse of the Were-Rabbit.
It's fabulous. It's absolutely fabulous. It's a proper movie. It's lit by people who understand how to make proper movies. It's fantastically British. It makes no concessions to the Americans. I laughed, smiled, cried.
Read that Katzenberg memo one more time.
Exactly. And no, it's just fantastic. And how great to see that alongside Corpse Bride bringing back stop-motion animation, because CG has really flattened an awful lot of great animation.
Alan, you said earlier you haven't seen it, but a fan of Nick Park anyway.
I think he's a genius, yes. He's quite wonderful. Yes, I think it's great.
Earlier you made derogatory comments about our sportscaster's assessment of what Thierry Henry and Robert Perez were actually saying, and they're kind of disquiet about what's happening at Arsenal. Vassos Alexander is here.
Alan, I brought you the PA story about the Robert Perez quotes. And not only that, but it actually comes from an interview he gave to the French newspaper L'Equipe. And I speak French, and so I did check that story on the L'Equipe website. Not that I don't trust PA, it's a very trustworthy news source, but I just wanted to check that they weren't a press association.
What does he say?
And the full quote is, I will see in the January if the club's ambitions please me or not. I said Robert Perez wanted to stay to the new year to see if the club's ambitions please him or not. And we all know about the Thierry Henry contract saga.
That's Perez. I hadn't heard the Perez, no. It was
With regards to Thierry Henry, he has said many times that he's not going to discuss a new contract until the summer, when he'll only have 12 months to go on his current deal. Yeah. Arsene Wenger said he wanted to do it in the last 2 months when Henry was injured.
He did.
Therefore, we draw the conclusion that there has to be some doubt on his future, otherwise he'd come out and say, well, look, I'll sign a new contract. Even when he broke Ian Wright's record on Tuesday, Thierry Henry came out and said, look,
it's not your job to come to conclusions. Your job is to read the news.
This is the news.
Right? No, the news is the quote.
Well, we're going to hear Thierry Henry.
Where does it say about Vieira?
You're about to hear it in the 3:30 Sport.
Okay.
I'll put the headphones on if I were you.
Okay, so Sir Alan's staying for the 3:30 Sport, and we'll see where it goes from there. It's a fight on.
Now the 5 Live Sports with Vassos Alexander.
And with some trepidation, Robert Perez has joined Thierry Henry in wanting to wait before committing his future to Arsenal. Perez wants to see if Arsenal's ambitions please him, or me plaît in the original, before deciding to sign a new contract at Highbury. He has been offered an extra year on his current deal, but wants a meeting with manager Arsene Wenger in the new year to decide whether he wants to stay. Henry, meanwhile, has admitted he's frustrated at Arsenal's lack of internationals on the bench compared to other clubs, and he's refusing to discuss a new contract until the summer. The striker's also blamed Arsenal's poor start to the Premier League season on a failure to replace Patrick Vieira.
They will never be the same team. Whoever comes into the team is not there. I won't see that tall tower in the middle of the park, you know, so who wouldn't miss Patrick Vieira? It's not the fact that I'm crying because he left. I'm not saying I don't understand why. That's not what I'm saying. Tell me what team in the world wouldn't like to have Patrick Vieira. So therefore, obviously, forever, we won't be the same team anymore because he's not here anymore.
Alan, you're desperate to say something.
Well, that isn't actually what you said. You know, I mean, in the end, he's, you know, he doesn't blame the poor start. Blame is a verb that you've interjected. He just says, who wouldn't in the world miss Patrick Vieira? He's one of the greatest players in the world, is what he says. And what he also said in more detail is that he's frustrated, which you don't say, he's frustrated sitting on the bench because he desperately wants to help his team. And because he's been injured, it's been very frustrating for him. It's not a criticism of the team.
Well, I didn't imply a criticism.
You didn't? All right.
I don't think I did. Apologies.
But it blames him.
Well, I mean, to be honest, he did do two interviews, and one was with a newspaper and one was ours, and I was giving the sense of one and the words of another. But, I mean, I think that's also fair enough. That's fair journalism. I mean, you don't want to hear sports news that's just bland.
I agree.
You know, Tottenham play Arsenal in the Premier League.
Is that high-flying Tottenham, by the way, in second place, is that?
Unusually high-flying Tottenham.
Yes. See, whatever it is. nice place adjective. Very well done.
Shall I press on?
It's such a pleasure to be in the studio with Alan Parker. He's not having a go at the film critic. He's having a go at the press.
That's the first time I've ever had a go at a newsreader, sorry.
The Chelsea manager, Jose Mourinho, admits to
An email comes in with a headline, Vassos versus Parker, from Len Horridge, who says, I can't wait to see the Alan Parker cartoon of Vassos. Is it out yet in French, please? anyway, Vassos, thank you very much indeed. You'll find Drive with Peter and Jane so much more relaxing.
Yeah, right? I'm looking forward to it.
Sir Alan, it's been good having you on the programme. Thank you very much indeed. Far more combative than we were expecting, and going into all kinds of entertaining areas. What do we get from you next? What are you working on after...
I promised my wife that I should stop doing cartoons and go and make a movie next year, so hopefully I'll do that.
Do you know what you're doing?
I have a couple of things I might do, but I don't know now.
Sorry, can I just say, when I said, do you know what you're doing?
It wasn't
a professional criticism. It was just...
Yeah, I know. Yeah. No, it's like you always feel like, unless you say, oh, actually, yeah, I'm going to do the new Harry Potter. You know, you feel like such a terrible loser.
Would you like to do the next Harry Potter?
No, I think there's a lot of very good people doing them.
Alan, thank you. That was splendidly diplomatic. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
For once.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Alan's book is called Will Write and Direct for Food, and is most entertaining. Alan, thank you very much indeed. And if you could sign it just before you go, that would be fantastic. So some movie reviews to come. This, first of all, from a Bristolian in the USA. He says, enjoying the programme, but must make this point. To get an MD, so this is back to the who's a doctor and who isn't, one must understand a discipline. To get a PhD, one must understand and also significantly add to a discipline. The PhD is the higher degree. This is demonstrated annually by the order that degrees are granted at university graduation ceremonies. PhD granting is the headline act. There are more of them than Knights of the Realm. That's also very true. Let's do some movie reviews. By the way, everything downloadable from the internet, of course, and then you can walk around with everything in your back pocket. Someone actually complained to me this week that they download the movies, they listen to them through the week, and you know that... incident. Thank you very much indeed, Sir Alan. Thank you. Remember when we were at Lord's?
Yes, I do remember very well when there was the incident. Yeah.
When there was the incident. Someone's complained that the downloadable version didn't contain the full incident.
Oh,
isn't that extraordinary? New movies this week include...
Tim Burton's Corpse Bride, a stop-motion animation from Tim Burton, which he, of course, says co-directed, but he does actually get a directorial credit on this, unlike, for example, Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, which was directed by Henry Selick. Story is a one young man, voiced by Johnny Depp, called Victor, is rehearsing his marriage vows to a bride who he loves but is equally one, but he can't get the vows right, so he stumbles out into the woods and practices his vows on something sticking out of the ground, which looks, you know, like a twig in the shape of a hand. He puts the ring on the twig. He says his marriage vows, only to discover that he has married the corpse bride.
Oh.
The dead bride, underground, voiced by Helena Bonham Carter, who then drags him down into the fantastically colourful underworld. So the remainder of the movie is he has to decide whether or not to stay with the corpse bride, to whom he is now wedded, or to go back to the land of the living to marry his actual bride, who, of course, lives in the land of the living, which is far more drab than the underworld. This being a Tim Burton movie, Tim Burton, you know, was a goth who grew up in California and always considered himself to be, you know, a bit weird and a bit oddball. And he was always into monster movies and Vincent Price and all the rest of it. He's made loads and loads of movies in which the central character is a kind of spiky-haired loner. I mean, think, for example, of Edward Scissorhands, or think of, you know, Vincent, his early cartoon. This, I think, is one of Burton's, you know, most personal films. I absolutely loved it. For a start, I think it's completely true that kids enjoy ghoulish humour. I mean, I grew up, you know, reading famous Monsters of Movie Land and Fangoria magazine and, you know, watching old Hammer reruns, and they didn't do me no harm. They were the thing that...
Well,
you
that's
know,
questionable.
No, but they really were the thing that gave me great pleasure. And I think nowadays... people have sort of this strange idea that if you're making movies for kids, they have to be saccharine sweet and they have to be, you know, nice and coated in sugar and all the rest of it. It's absolute nonsense. Kids like the ghoulishness. Now, I know that some parents may have a problem with taking their kids to see a movie which has the word corpse in the title. Don't be put off by that. No, obviously, it's not for everyone. There are certain moments. There's a beautifully on the BBFC description. It's a PG and it says contains mildly scary scenes. You know, mildly scary scenes. I don't know how you define that, because the gags are basically all about a bunch of dead people in the underworld. There's a
Isn't that a bit like saying slightly funny jokes?
I mean, yes, exactly.
Something is either scary
or not. And, I mean, I personally don't think that you would be scared by it, but let me describe a scenario. The Helena Bonham Carter character has an eyeball which keeps falling out, and in her skull is a maggot. And the maggot is basically the voice of her conscience or her alter ego. And, you know, she rolls her eyes at her boyfriend has to roll them back again. There's another bit in which he meets his dog, who is in the underworld because his dog is dead, and he says, hey, you know, play dead. Oh, sorry. And then he has to play fetch with his... I mean, it's like all the ghoulish, morbid humour that it ought to be. But the kicker of it is that there is more life in the underworld, that there is more colour in the underworld, there is more humour in the underworld. It's everything that's happening up on the ground that is boring and grey and drab. Now, I absolutely love that. And I think if you are slightly on that, you know, what's the Adams thing? They're fabulous and kooky. If you're ooky, kooky, spooky and all the rest of it, then you will absolutely love it. Yes, it's probably true that very straight, very easily distressed young kids probably won't get the glorious, ghoulish nature of it. So it's probably, you know, very young kids, very sensitive kids, kids who haven't, you know, an issue with anything to do with it, fine, in that case. But honestly, I thought it was lovely. I thought it was sweet. I thought it was charming. I thought it was funny. I thought it was personal. I thought it was beautifully designed. And how great to see stop-motion animation come back, because, you know, CGI has lent such a sheen to everything. And, of course, it has a score by Danny Elfman, better songs, incidentally, than Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, although they're both on the same kind of slightly creepy, slightly strange, slightly off-kilter in a very, very lovely fashion.
Sounds a bit like Beetlejuice.
Yeah, well, because I love Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice is a fantastic film, which there's a brilliant line in Beetlejuice when the Michael Keaton character, that he's saying that he's terribly evil. And they say, well, you know, how can you prove that you're evil? He says, how can I prove it? I've seen The Exorcist 20 times and it just gets funnier.
Funny how that would appeal.
It is. I loved it. I really like Corpse Bride.
And then, of course, Michael Keaton went on to make one of the worst movies of all time.
Which one was
Jack
that?
Jack Frost.
Oh, yes. Awful. There's no dad. No, Snow Dad's better than no dad.
I like this from Mick in Newcastle. First rule of Fight Club, don't annoy Vassos. So there you go. That battle is over. 14-4. More reviews in a second. Is Nick with the latest travel. John in Brighton, hats off to Mark for recommending History of Violence, a class act compared to the soundtracked amoral violence of Mr. Ritchie et al.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Rob Wiltshire, Simon and Mark, you described Wings of Desire as a flawed masterpiece. Can you tell me where the flaw is, in your opinion, as I think it's superb and is in my top three films, along with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Destry Rides Again?
Well, I mean, the choice I was given was flawed masterpiece or total stinker. So I went for flawed masterpiece as opposed to total stinker. I mean, I think if there is a flaw in all Wim Wenders' films, it's that he has a habit of drifting into sentimentality a little too easily. But in the case of Wings of Desire, I think it's reined in.
So we've done Tim Burton's Corpse Bride, which most regulars will suspect is going to be movie of the week. But anyway, here's Emma Thompson.
Yeah, now, Nanny McPhee, strange enough, Nanny McPhee has a U certificate, and it's Emma Thompson. She wrote the script, she stars in it. So therefore, it looks like being all good and wholesome and nice on the outside. Based on the Nurse Matilda series of books by Christiana Brand, I have to confess that I haven't read any of them. And yet, the surprising thing about it is that actually, it's not as sweet and nice and lovely as the U certificate and the Emma Thompson stamp of approval may seem to suggest. The film starts at the beginning with a rabble of kids being terribly misbehaved, and Colin Firth is an undertaker. So straight again, we're in the mortuary. Colin Firth is the father. The children no longer have a mother. They have scared off all their nannies in the manner of the opening of Mary Poppins. Remember, Mary Poppins opens and the last nanny...
Nanny's resigning, walking out.
Exactly. Elsa Lanchester, in fact. Face that could stop a coal barge, as they say in the... Yeah, Elsa Lanchester, Bride of Frankenstein.
Absolutely. So obviously everyone knows what you're talking about.
Elsa Lanchester, Bride of Frankenstein, is the nanny in the beginning. So this is basically scary Mary Poppins. All the nannies have been thrown out. Colin Firth is saying, it's okay, you know, we've got the last nanny. There's nothing they can do that's possibly going to get rid of this nanny. And then the nanny comes in and says, they've eaten the baby! And the opening set piece is Colin Firth runs into his house to find his children apparently having eaten their baby brother. Now, it's okay, I'm not giving anything away to tell you that they haven't. It's just a gag. But as grueling cannibal gags in a U certificate movie goes, it's one of the best. After that, from out of nowhere, comes scary Mary Poppins, Nanny McPhee, played by Emma Thompson, warts, big schnoz, humpback, straggly hair, all over the place to turn their lives around. So as you can hear from that, there is much more than just a hint of Mary Poppins. Because if you remember, Mary Poppins, that's her terms as well, is that she has, I think it's Wednesday afternoons off.
Firth sounds like Colin being very Colin Firth.
But he is, I mean, I really like Colin Firth. I think he's a very good comic actor. He's a very edgy actor. And incidentally, he's terrific in the new Atom Egoyan film, Where the Truth Lies, which is really going to give Colin Firth fans a real surprise, because it's not what you expect from Colin Firth. The thing about Nanny McPhee is it is designed in this absolutely vomit-inducing colour scheme. I mean, deliberately vomit-inducing, like puce greens and vulgars and disgusting apples and tawdry browns. I mean, it is really like putting your head into a cake mix. I mean, it's a disgusting movie to look at in the best kind of way. It owes a certain aesthetic depth to Danny DeVito's brilliant adaptation of Matilda, the Roald Dahl Matilda, which I absolutely love and I think is a rather underrated movie and has developed a fantastic following on DVD, and, you know, as well it might. It's one of my just absolute favourite pieces of work. I don't think that Nanny McPhee is quite on a par with it, and there's a lot of things wrong with it. It does, in the end, do its kind of moralising in a very nice, ordinary way, that as the kids learn their lessons, Nanny loses warts, and so consequently, as they become better, she becomes more beautiful. Obviously, it's a moral tale, it's a parable, but I have to say, I'm surprised about how much good, grotesque nastiness there was in a Eustificat film, and I see from some of the reviews today in the broadsheets that they've kicked it all around town, and I think wrongly so. I think there are many things to commend it, and I did laugh and cackle many times.
I think when we spoke to Emma Thompson on the programme last week, she was saying, well, she was implying that there's some kind of, there's a hint of Eastern mysticism about Nanny McPhee, that there's this kind of a Zen thing going on, that actually, that she isn't a character.
Yes, that she is a moral compass who just encourages them to discover the things that they have in themselves already.
If now, you need her, she will come.
Yes, and the thing is, when you don't want me but you need me, I'll be here. But when you want me but you don't need me, I won't be. And that's the Zen mysticism ooga booga thing. But then again, that's Mary Poppins, because as you probably remember, you know, the whole thing about Mary Poppins is at the end of Mary Poppins, she has to leave. And it's always heartbreaking because her walking stick talks to her and says, you know, aren't you heartbroken at leaving the children? She says, practically perfect people never, you know, hold any grudges. And then she flies off. And clearly, Nanny McPhee is not Mary Poppins, because I think Mary Poppins is a masterpiece. But I do think that Emma Thompson does understand the darker side of kids' humour, and I think she's had at least a stab at it in Nanny McPhee.
What else do we have this week?
Broken Flowers, the new movie by Jim Jarmusch, with yet another perfect, potentially Oscar-nominatable vehicle for Bill Murray, who, as regular listeners will know, I think is one of the screen's finest presences. He was nominated for Sofia Coppola's Lost in Translation, and everyone thought that he was in with a shout and was kind of savagely disappointed when he didn't get it. In many ways, Broken Flowers is sort of a return to a similar deadpan character. The story here is he plays an aging roué, a sort of Don Juan figure, actually called Don, who receives a letter out of the blue from one of his exes, which says, I just wanted you to know you have a son, and the son is this age. He doesn't know which ex it is, but his next-door neighbour, who has a detective bent, says, we must find out all the people you knew at around that time, and you must go and visit them all, one by one. And they are played by a selection of stellar stars, like, you know, Sharon Stone plays one of his earlier loves. And they're all much more glamorous than he is, but he goes to each one, Tilda Swinton, and tries to discover what's happened to them since their relationship broke up. Now, as you can tell from that clip, which is kind of full of Pinter-esque gaps, what the film is doing most of the time is just watching Bill Murray watching everything around him. And there is almost no greater cinematic spectacle than Bill Murray's incredibly, you know, droll, downbeat, hangdog face.
He did that in his last movie and the movie before that.
Well, you mean he did that in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou?
He did indeed.
Which I enjoyed much more than you did. Mm-hmm. And he did it to some extent in Lost in Translation. And you kind of forget that he made his name originally as, you know, a comedian. I mean, the Ghostbusters was the huge big break for him. But before that, he was in knockabout comedies. And, of course, he was fabulously in a comedy called Quick Change, in which he plays somebody who holds up a bank whilst dressed as a clown, but with that glum expression. And the bank manager says, what kind of clown are you anyway? And he says, the crying on the inside kind, I guess. And that is exactly what kind of clown Bill Murray is. I really like this. I'm a big Jim Jarmusch fan. I think Stranger Than Paradise is a lovely, classic, independent movie, and it's really nice to see that Jarmusch has managed to keep his independence whilst everyone around has to some extent sold out to the studio system. There are very few directors who could make a movie like this. It's fantastically inconsequential in a way which is actually very moving. There is a certain element of baggy old man goes to visit fantastically glamorous, you know, flames, played by people like Jessica Lange, and people have said, well, this is just the same male fantasy as the one in Lost in Translation, in which one imagines that if you look like Bill Murray, you'd actually have a chance of having a relationship with Scarlett Johansson, which I think in the real world is probably not how things actually work out. But that aside, I thought it had that charming, incidental comedy quality that Jarmusch's work at its best has. It's real observational stuff. It's really rib-tickling and heartwarming and melancholic all at the same time. And nobody does this stuff better than Murray. And yes, one could level a criticism of he has done this character before. But you know what? I don't care. I actually don't care if Bill Murray does this character from now till Kingdom Come, because I would rather watch somebody doing reactive comedy, doing deadpan comedy like that, than all the wacky, bendy-faced, you know, Deuce Bigelow, European gigolo nonsense.
Surely, but there must be something else. I mean, well, it doesn't have to start doing Deuce Bigelow to actually do something that's slightly different from this.
I think it's very likely that Bill Murray...
actor with long, Pinterest-esque gaps in everything.
Well,
he
will do other things.
Looking moodily at...
He will do other things, but it just so happens that there have been a trilogy of movies at this point in his career, each one of which seemed to reflect a similar side of the character. So, I mean, I really, really love Broken Flowers. I thought it was great. Can I just say very quickly, and I mustn't forget this, on Monday night, there's a documentary going out called The Real Amityville Horror. And I mentioned it because it was made by the guy who directed the Exodus documentary that I made years ago, The Fear of God. And if you like The Fear of God, The Real Amityville Horror on Channel 4 is very, very interesting.
Are you in it?
No, I'm not. No, but I'm just mentioning.
Okay, you've got 30 seconds.
The only other thing which is out is Sky High, which is basically a live-action version of The Incredibles with Kurt Russell and a cameo appearance by Linda Carter, who makes the joke halfway through, "I'm not Wonder Woman, you know," and the whole audience of a certain age go, "Yes, you are!" And the incredible thing about Sky High from the trailers, it looked absolutely awful. But in fact, it's really not bad. It's actually quite funny. It's actually quite acerbic. Yeah, and it's, you know, it's not a great movie, but it's nothing like as bad as it could have been.
And
I did laugh.
They took a dull bit from the movie and made it the trail.
Unbelievably so, yes.
An interesting idea.
Mm.
Mark, thank you very much indeed. Have a good weekend. We'll see you next week. All the reviews are up on the website. You can download them and then walk around with them for the rest of the week. Who could ask for more fun? Have a good weekend. We'll see you Monday at 1. Drive comes next on AM, on digital and online. You're listening to Five Live.